We are back with Peter Galbraith. He is talking about many ideas that he has encoded really clearly and well in his book. That's a plug for the book. Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. You are clear, you are concise, and you are experienced in this. This is not an abstraction for you, and you were going forth
with I want to say one thing before you continue with what was very important, which is that Al-Qaeda was not a force in Iraq prior to our presence there. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So the fact that we're suppressing Al-Qaeda and have had some success with that...
Collectively, is
part of the fundamental misapprehension going in to Iraq.
That's certainly true. Al-Qaeda is a problem in many places. It was not a problem in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It became a problem, and now because of the awakening, it is less of a problem. But I think in order to understand the problems that lie ahead, it's important to understand something about the awakening. These are the tribal sheikhs in Anbar and their allies in the Sunni parts of Baghdad and in Saladin governorate, where Tikrit, where Saddam Hussein was from. And these were the people who most opposed the American invasion. And in April 2003, you had the beginnings of the insurgency. Now, these people, incidentally, who are they? They were the people who were running Iraq. They were the Ba'athists. And so the insurgency began as a Ba'athist movement, as a movement of Saddamists, people loyal to Saddam Hussein. They were then joined by this religious element, these Sunni fundamentalists, Salafi jihadis who subscribe to a very puritanical version of Islam and believe that infidels in Muslim countries should be killed and that apostates like Shiites should be killed. And because they were so brutal and because, frankly, they were very good at their public relations in their brutality, videotaped beheadings, bomb attacks that killed thousands of Shiite pilgrims, this fundamentalist element began to become the dominant one in the insurgency. Now, the Sunni tribal sheikhs had no problem with the Al-Qaeda and the other fundamentalists as long as they were killing Americans, as long as they were killing innocent Shiite civilians. But then these Al-Qaeda types began to kidnap and force into marriage the daughters of the sheikhs. That's just another word for rape, incidentally, forced marriage. They began to shake down the tribal leaders for money, and they began to assassinate them. And so seeing their own position threatened by Al-Qaeda, that's when these sheikhs went to the Americans and asked them to finance the militias, the militia that is now known as the Awakening. And that was a very successful strategy from the American point of view. The Awakening did strike a major blow at Al-Qaeda. But who is it that we're now working with? We are working with, and we have empowered, in the Sunni areas of Iraq, the very people we invaded Iraq in 2003 to get rid of. And I do not define that as success.
It's also worth saying that the Ba'athist was a relatively secular party. That the religious piece of this is again a consequence of the American invasion. Is that correct?
It certainly began that way.
Has happened.
But by the end of Saddam's rule, there was a more religious element in there. But my point is that it's certainly true that the Ba'athists are, from an American point of view, preferable to Al-Qaeda. But it's certainly... We can hardly look back and say we've won a victory or had a success when, after all the money we've spent, all the sacrifices we've made, we end up with the very same people in power 6 years later.
One of the things I found really important in my own thing, and really this reads like an adventure novel, except that there's more pain and bloodshed than I would typically do to myself if I were reading fiction, this being all too real. importance of geography in all of this, the importance of taking a step back and saying, look at the whole world. Look how ethnicity and religion and the detritus that comes after colonialism. Look at the big picture and look at Iraq and look how badly we went awry and how much there is to be learned from it. Is that right?
Well, one of the things I did in this book, it has a number of elements to it. It is a description of where we are in 2008 in Iraq, an explanation of why the surge has not been a success. It very much seeks to settle the question of who lost Iraq. And then it looks forward. So there's strategies for Iraq, for Iran, for Turkey. And then another part of the book looks at some of the larger questions. What is it that we have been getting wrong? And as I've thought about the conflicts of the last 20 years and what are going to be the crises of the next 20, and incidentally, these always take you by surprise. If we were having this conversation in 1990, who amongst us would have thought that that Bosnia and Herzegovina, a place that most policymakers hadn't heard of, would be front and center, or Kosovo? And yet, that's what happened. And so I tried to think, well, where are we going to find, you know, what are going to be these places in the second decade of this century? And I realized, and of course I've lived through this as ambassador to Croatia and much of my other work in Iraq and elsewhere, that all the conflicts that we've had in the last 20 years, with the exception of Haiti, have involved ethnic nationalism and separatism. And so then the question is, well, what kind of policy should we have toward that? It has been, the U.S. has been reflexively committed to the unity and territorial integrity of every country that exists on the map. In 1991, the first President Bush went to Kiev on August 1st, spoke to the Ukrainian parliament to warn them against Ukrainian nationalism. By the end of the year, the Ukraine was an independent country. Why was it that the U.S. and the first President Bush thought it was so important that we should hold the Soviet Union together? Is the world better off, worse off because there is no Soviet Union? Of course not. And they made, I mean, there weren't consequences of Bush's Chicken Kiev speech, as it was called, but there were huge consequences of what happened 6 weeks earlier when James Baker went to Belgrade and met with the presidents of the six republics of the former Yugoslavia and told them that if they broke the country apart, that they couldn't count on any support or sympathy from the U.S. Well, that was June 21, 1991. 4 days later, Slovenia and Croatia declared their independence. There was no chance that Baker could have dissuaded them. The populations had voted overwhelmingly for independence. The two presidents, Kuchan and Slovenia, Tudjman and Croatia, were themselves totally committed to independence. But the message he sent to Milosevic was, you have a free hand to attack. And as I look ahead, I can also see that we're going to face these kinds of challenges in the future. Iraq, as a country, I argue, is already broken up, but Burma could become Yugoslavia's. It could become Asia's Yugoslavia when the military junta goes. There are separatist movements in Indonesia. Sudan will divide in the coming few years when there's a referendum in South Sudan, and the list is actually quite long. And so what I argue is that we should anticipate this, and we should be more flexible in our approach. There are plenty of cases when the best choice is to try to hold a country together. But in other cases, the best approach might be able to work to have a velvet divorce, like between the Czechs and the Slovaks. The overriding goal should not be the preservation of existing countries. The overriding goal should be stability and avoiding violence.
Taking Iraq is a case study. You brought up a treaty whose name I will not even try to repeat, 1639 treaty, and then there is the post-First World War creation of Iraq, part of what is so important, and you emphasize the importance of understanding the context, of understanding the history. But, you know, starting in 1639...
Or even having been there.
And coming rapidly forward, what can we learn from history? Because it seems that Americans, you know, almost uniquely, are just determined to ignore what has gone before.
Well, I do talk at some length about the Treaty of Kayseri-Schwerin in 1639, which demarcated the boundary between the Persian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, what is now the boundary between Iraq and Iran.
This was historically very, I mean, these were the major empires at that time in that part of the world.
This is the frontier between Persia and Arabia.
Actually, of the Ottomans, the Turkish Empire. It became, after the First World War, the frontier between Persia, the Persians, and the Arabs. But more importantly, it was the frontier between the Shiite-ruled world of Persia, and now Iran, and the Sunni-ruled world of the Ottoman Empire and the Arab world. And in 1980, you don't have to go back to 1639, from 1980 to 1988, an 8-year war was fought between Iraq and Iran over the lines that were drawn in the Treaty of Kayseri-Schwerin, with the Iraqis initially trying to grab some Arab-populated territory from Iran, and the Iranians trying to come into Iraq and get rid of Saddam Hussein and install the Shiite parties that they'd been supporting. And that war was fought to a standstill. The U.S. in 2003 invaded Iraq, swept away this brutal Sunni dictatorship, dissolved the army, which was the Sunni-dominated army, which was how successive Sunni dictators had stayed in power, allowed looters to destroy the government offices, and then fired the top bureaucrats. Thus, the bureaucracy, the Sunni-dominated bureaucracy, the other way the Sunnis had stayed in power. And then George Bush's appointee, Jerry Bremer, and his team, knowing nothing, enabled the cadres from the Shiite religious party supported by Iran to take senior positions in the Iraqi bureaucracy and in the newly constituted Iraqi army and police. And, of course, at the end of the day, Iran accomplished its greatest strategic gain since the Treaty of Kayseri-Schwerin, and it was done by people who had no knowledge of history, no knowledge of the region. It was unwitting. That's what's so amazing about the whole thing.
I want to go back to this who lost Iraq.
Can we
question.
Do that when we start again in a moment?
Yes.
Peter Galbraith is with us. Bill Russell will pose who lost Iraq. I know the answer, having read Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthen America Enemies. What a concept. Paula Gordon, be with us when we return.